lyssnar nu på inspelningen från seminariet Ojämlikhet, vad kan vi göra? Ett seminarium som Arena Idé arrangerade tillsammans med LO den 2 november. I den här delen av seminariet så hör du Tony Atkinson presentera sina konkreta förslag för att minska inkomstskillnader. Missa inte den andra delen av seminariet där LOs chefsekonom Ola Pettersson och statssekreterare Carolina Ekholm kommenterar Tony Atkinsons presentation. Vill ni se Tony Atkinsons bilder från seminariet, gå in på arenaid.se. Eller vill ni se filmen från seminariet, gå in på LO Play. Där ligger hela inspelningen upplagd.
The United States President Barack Obama has described inequality as the defining challenge of our time. The Pope has called for governments to redistribute wealth to the poor in a new spirit of generosity. Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF, more pragmatically, has said that inequality threatens the stability of the world economic system. But what the world leaders have not said is precisely what they would do about it. And there are repeated calls for equitable growth, but little clue as to how that's going to be achieved. And that's the main reason that I've written a book called Inequality, What Can Be Done? And I wrote it partly out of a sense of irritation, because I was constantly being asked the question by colleagues, policymakers, and people in the wider world, my friends, relatives. People would stop me in the street and say, what can we do about it? So that's why I wrote the book. And the key message is that the present levels of inequality, both nationally and globally, are not inevitable. We're not simply at the mercy of forces beyond our control. If, and that's a big if we want to reduce inequality, then there are steps that we can take. They're not necessarily easy, and they're almost certainly going to be losers as well as gainers. We'd have to discard economic and political orthodoxies. If our leaders are serious about tackling inequality, then they have to move outside their comfort zone, doing more than they are at present. At the same time, I should emphasize that while I should make proposals which some people regard as radical, I'm not trying to describe some kind of utopia. Very much influenced by Amartya Sen's recent book, The Idea of Inequality, where he argued that what we should be doing is thinking not about some distant utopian state, but where we want to move to from where we are. And that's very much the spirit in which I've written this, that I'm concerned with measures that would reduce inequality with the direction of movement, not necessarily with where we're going to end up. Because I think many people would differ. And they would differ about where they want to end up while agreeing that they think that the current levels of inequality are excessive. So that's what I've set out to do. Just to explain what I'm going to be talking about more concretely, this is about economic inequality, which, of course, can refer to a number of different things. And I put up this rather simple-minded sort of household account just to underline the fact that there are quite a number of different dimensions of economic inequality. And while economists tend to focus on earned income, the differences in pay between the top and the bottom, earnings are an important part of household incomes and an important source of inequality. But they're not the only one. And we have to, for example, think about how households are made up. So it's not just individual earnings, it's the total earnings of the household. We have to think about capital income, and that's one of the things that Thomas Piketty, particularly his book, brought out. And of course, we have to allow for taxes and transfers, and we have to allow for different needs of different households, and so on. At this point, also, I should stress that I'm going to talk mainly about what I would call vertical inequality, rich and poor. But there are, of course, very important horizontal inequalities. Inequalities between men and women, inequalities between generations, for example, inequalities between ethnic groups. And quite a number of the proposals are certainly concerned with gender inequality and with intergenerational inequality. So this should be borne in mind, although most of the evidence I'm going to talk about is actually about vertical inequality. And this slide shows something which is probably reasonably familiar to you. That is that between countries, there are big differences in household income inequality. The data are taken from the Luxembourg Income Study, which provides broadly comparable information for different countries. And you can see that my own country is pretty high. And this is a table where you want to be down the bottom, not at the top. We're next to the United States. And the Nordic countries, Denmark, Norway, down the bottom. Where is Sweden? Where is Sweden in this? Well, I'm afraid Sweden is not any longer taking part in the international comparative exercise, which the Luxembourg Income Study is. They're not willing to supply the data one needs to make comparable estimates across countries, which is a great pity, since Sweden was one of the founding members of the Luxembourg Income Study and has been a pioneer of this kind of research. So Sweden doesn't appear on my graph. I hope one day it will reappear. So I'll look just briefly at national sources. And this brings out that the experience of Sweden has a number of features common with other European countries, particularly the reduction in inequality of wealth, very strikingly, but of the shares at the top 1%, and also overall inequality measured by the Gini coefficients. There was a declining reduction, there was a reduction in inequality from about three, possibly slightly more, decades after the Second World War. And that's something which many European countries found. And indeed, one question we have to ask is, can we learn from that about how we might go back to reducing inequality, given that it has increased since 1980, overall inequality, and I know that there are a variety of figures for Sweden, and so I've just put on here two. One is the SCB series, and the other is the OECD series. They look rather different in level. You can see one is the squares on the right-hand side, and the other is the circles, the grey colour. But they both show, as I'm sure you're all aware, that overall inequality has been rising in recent years in Sweden. And the rise, in fact, depending which series you take, is perhaps not far short of the rise that happened in the United Kingdom earlier than this in the 1980s. We had an increase of about 10 percentage points in the Gini coefficient. And that's a big increase. Just to give you an indication, if you tried to offset this purely through income taxation, that is pushing up the rates of income tax at the top, which are already, of course, in this country quite high, you'd have to raise them by about somewhere between 15 and 20 percentage points to get the Gini coefficient down by 10 percentage points. But it's not just overall inequality. One of the reasons I wrote the book was I felt following the Piketty Capital in the 21st century, most of the attention had focused on the top of the distribution. Now, I think that's important, and I and others in the audience have worked on the shares of the top 1%. But I think there's a risk that we'll focus too much on the exotic parts at the top and neglect what's happening at the bottom. One can see there that the poverty rate has gone up quite significantly, from somewhere around 7 to around 14% in Sweden, which is a pretty staggering increase. A pretty staggering increase when we're trying to reduce the poverty rate. And we seem to have forgotten the Europe 2020 agenda. I see blank faces. If I mention it in the United Kingdom, people have no idea what the Europe 2020 agenda is. But the European leaders signed up in 2010 to five major goals, one of which was reducing by 20 million the number of people at risk of poverty and social exclusion. And we aren't making any progress. So, quite a lot of what I was going to be concerned with is with trying to suggest measures that will reduce poverty. As I said at the beginning, I'm also interested in horizontal as well as vertical inequality. And so I just want to show you one final piece of evidence about inequality, which I'd be interested in your reactions. It shows gender inequality at the top of the distribution. And I remember I asked Thomas Piketty once, how many of the top 1% are women? And he didn't know, and he didn't say, because in France, you're taxed jointly as husband and wife, and so it's quite difficult. But quite a lot of countries have individual taxation, including the two shown here, Denmark and the United Kingdom. And we haven't yet been able to do the calculations for Sweden, but my co-authors, Alessandra Casarico and Sarah Wojcicki, were all rather surprised to see, well, two things about this are rather surprising. The first is that the figures for Denmark and the United Kingdom are very similar. They're very similar numbers in the top 10%. That is, somewhere about 28% of the top 1% are women. So 72% of men, 28% are women. And I expected Denmark to do a lot better on gender inequality. The other thing that's striking is that the proportion of women in the top 10% has been rising, as I think one would probably expect from what's happened in the labour market and so on. But down here, the top 0.1%, which is rather up there in terms of income, the very top, look at it, it's virtually unchanged since 1980 in Denmark and 1995 in the UK. So we're not seeing much progress in terms of reducing inequality at the very top in terms of gender. And then the final aspect, which I should just mention in setting the scene, is that both Sweden and my own country are part of a wider world. And international inequality, that is inequality between countries, has indeed been falling, and world poverty has fallen. And the World Bank is now talking about numbers below 1 billion. In fact, the latest estimate was 902 million. And I did wonder whether the two was necessary. They could measure it quite so precisely as that, but anyway. But, I think if I'd been there, I'd have said 900 would be sufficient for that purpose. But this, again, brings to something else that we've signed up to. We've signed up to the Sustainable Development Goals, which, of course, include goals for poverty reduction, not just in poor countries in terms of extreme poverty, but also goal 1.2 is to halve poverty in rich countries. I don't know if I never saw that emphasized in the press coverage, but its goal 1.2 is addressed at us. There's also goal 10, which is to reduce inequality. I'll come back to that at the end. So let me now turn to, first of all, some of the explanation as to why inequality has risen, and then how that leads to the proposals. And people often accuse economists of being very slow to catch up with what's happening in the world. They're always sort of preparing for the crisis before last, as it were. I don't think that's actually true. I mean, I think that economists are actually rather quick, usually. And this is an example. I think within a few years of inequality starting to rise in the US, almost all American textbooks had a section about explaining that. And the explanation you find was a simple supply and demand explanation, which originally had been proposed by the Dutch economist Jan Tinbergen, in which he described a race between education increasing the supply of educated and skilled workers and technological change increasing the demand. And as he said, if the demand grows faster than the supply, that will push up the wages of skilled workers, and so we'll see a more unequal distribution of wages. And today, we would add to his account, globalization was another important force. So there's two forces. The usual reasons you'll find is explaining why inequalities increase. Now, this standard story is accompanied by the policy prescription. And I said at the beginning that our leaders haven't said what they would do. They have said, to some extent, they have said that they would want to invest in education and training. They want to invest in human capital. They want to invest in early years, for example. So I think that's one area where I think it's fair to say certainly a clearer lead has been given as to what could be done. And that's something which I totally support. I'm not in any way criticising that as a route to reduce inequality, and I think it's almost certainly an important part of doing so. But what I also feel is that this is only part of the story. And so I won't spend any time more discussing that. I'm going to take that for granted. What I want to say, though, is why it's only part of the story. And the first reason it's only part of the story is that these forces I mentioned, technological change and globalization, are not somehow things that arrive from outer space. They're not something which is sort of exogenous to us. Both of them are things which reflect policy choices and decisions that we've made as individuals, workers and employers and so on. And so if in fact they're a result of decisions, that means we aren't totally powerless in the face of events. So most technological advances, like the smartphone that you were asking us to turn off earlier on, that reflected decisions that were made by scientists, by businessmen, by investors, by consumers, and importantly by governments. And much of the technological developments, the fundamental technological developments that lie behind the technology or smartphone, were actually developed in government or university research institutions. Very little of it came out of the research institutions of the companies that make it. So things like the touchscreen, for example, was invented, I think, with people in France, French CNRS lab, or someone in Germany, and was people working in the radar research laboratory in Britain. Now, the main beneficiaries have clearly been the Google and Apple and others. So the point I want to make is that this is something that reflects decisions. And the bias in technological change, the bias which may favour skilled workers or which may favour capital as opposed to labour, that bias is something which is endogenous. And indeed, there was a large literature in the 1960s, which was when I was a student, about endogenous technical change, about how the fact that firms decided what kind of technical change to have. So it seems to me that if those are the forces that are driving earnings, then we need to ask the questions, how are those decisions taken? And are those decisions taken in the wider social interest or simply to maximise the profits of the companies concerned? A company might, for example, decide to invest in installing robots in its warehouse. You can probably imagine which company I have in mind. And it may invest, as I think it is doing now, in designing drones to deliver goods to your doorstep. In that way, it can get by with a very small labour force. There's no room for trade union organisation. You don't have many drones as your members, I wouldn't think. So, clearly, that decision to do that is something which, as I said, reflects the interests, in that case, of the company. And what I'm arguing in the book, is that actually we need to think about the implications of technological change. And to give another example, the programs for driverless cars have been funded by the US military and by a Europe-wide research program. Now, the US military, one can't do anything about much, but why is the European Union investing in driverless cars? Why are they not investing, for example, in designing home aids to allow the elderly to stay longer in their homes rather than go into hospital or sheltered care? That's clearly a choice. And how those choices are made will affect everyone. It'll affect workers, because taxi drivers will lose their jobs if you have driverless cars. It'll affect consumers, because actually I prefer to have a driver in my car if I'm going somewhere. You can ask them, we're going to the right place, or you can ask them what's going on. And journalists, after all, would, I think, lose many of their best sources if they were in driverless taxis. So those issues about technological change are ones then which should therefore be taken as relevant to what is happening to the distribution of income. Or put differently, if you're concerned about inequality, then you should also make sure that the Minister for Science is engaged in considering the implications, as well as the Minister for Social Affairs or the Minister for Treasury. Now, the second reason why it's only part of the story is, as I said at the beginning, there are lots of other things apart from how much an individual earns. And so these mechanisms, which you'll see there circled, sort of structure the proposals that I'm making in the book. There are, in fact, 15 proposals in the book. So if you're looking surreptitiously at your watches and wondering whether I'm going to discuss all 15 of them in detail, the answer is I'm not. So I want to make some more general points. Some of the proposals are indeed more relevant to some countries than others, and so I won't go into those. But the first one I wanted to talk about is taxation and the welfare state. I said earlier we should think about what lessons we could learn from the earlier decades after the Second World War when inequality fell. And one of the things that certainly was going on at that time was we were seeing the maturing of the welfare state, maturing of pension systems, maturing of other support, and we were seeing the financing of it in part by progressive taxation. Equally, turning it the other way round, one of the reasons why inequality, overall income inequality, has increased is that we've seen, to some degree and to different degree in different countries, we've seen an unwinding of the welfare state. And that unwinding has had adverse distributional consequences. The OECD Secretary General, in his report Divided We Stand, spelt out that from the mid-1990s, the reduced redistributive capacity of tax benefit systems was sometimes the main source of widening household income gaps. And I see from the 215 report of the Swedish Fiscal Policy Committee that they concluded that fiscal policy today is less redistributive than in the mid-1990s. So one thing one can do is obviously to go back to some of the measures that we had, which involves partly raising taxation. And rather than discuss how I'd raise taxation, because I think this is very much varies from country to country, I want to make a more general point, which is that tax policy seems to me to have lost its way. It's become very defensive. With all due respect to the Secretary of State, politicians are not defending taxes, I think, in the way they should. And the main problem is it lacks a narrative. It lacks a story as to why we pay taxes. And I think a good example is provided by the taxation of inherited wealth, which I think has been abolished in this country. That's right. Yeah. And I can quite understand that the tax on inherited wealth in Sweden was not fit for purpose in its form at that time. The UK inheritance tax is also not fit for purpose. But I think we need to spell out the purpose. What is the purpose of the inheritance tax? And I think the main purpose of it is related to the goal of reducing inequality of opportunity. And this is something which most people agree with. I mean, how many people here are against equality of opportunity? No, every politician is usually in favour of it, or virtually every. Now, if that's the case, then, I mean, I was struck the Republican, a number of the Republicans were referring to this, saying, oh, yes, we're in favour of equality of opportunity, but we're against having the estate tax. And it seems to me that if one wants to have a reasonably level playing field in terms of people's material wealth, then we have to have a tax that is based on, not as it was in your country or in mine, it is in mine, but on the total amount received over people's lifetimes in gifts and inheritances. Because the unequal starting point depends on how much you've received from different sources, your parents, from your uncle, or so on, and in gifts and bequests. And I think the problems with our inheritance tax were in the past is it was not a comprehensive tax. But by making the point also, because if one wants to ask whether the inheritance tax actually was achieving its redistributive goals, then what you need to look at is the tax paid in relation to the lifetime receipts of capital. It's not in relation to current wealth or current income. So the criterion one needs to look at is that. Equally, because of the narrative, I propose in the book that the revenue from the wealth transfer tax should be used as a negative tax to finance a modest payment to everyone on reaching the age of 18, as proposed by Thomas Paine in 1797. So everyone reaching the age of 18 would have a sum, not very large probably, but enough certainly to contribute to their costs of education or getting them on the housing ladder, and so on. So much for taxation. Spending more. I'm an unmitigated fan of child benefit. And child benefit is, by which I mean basically a cash amount paid for every child, regardless of their family circumstances. It could be subject to tax, income tax, which will then taper it in some way. And I'm so much in favour of it that I've proposed, in fact several times in the past, that the European Union should adopt this as its first sort of major social policy initiative by requiring all member states to have child benefit paid as a certain percentage of their income, the median income in that country, run under subsidiarity, so it could be run in Sweden as you chose, it could be, for example, provided in kind as well as cash, and so on. So there would be considerable scope for national choices, but that each state should have some minimum provision for children. And it seems to me this is a good idea, first of all, because it would actually show Europe doing something positive in the field of social policy, but secondly, because it would contribute undoubtedly to reducing child poverty. It would be one clear way of moving towards the 2020 objective of reducing poverty. Now, I also referred to adult basic income. And I know that's had a rather bad press in Sweden, right? That there's no great enthusiasm for a citizen's income. I don't want a citizen's income either. In fact, I don't think we could have a citizen's income because as long as we're members of the European Union, we can't not pay it to Swedes who work in London. And equally, we have many, many British people living all around the world who never appear on our shores who are British citizens. So I don't think citizenship works. That's why, partly influenced now 20-odd years ago by trade union and other objections to a citizen's income, I propose that we should have a conditional basic income based on participation, where that would involve either employment, but would go beyond employment, obviously self-employment, include training, include caring, and so on. So a participation income would be one way, I think, of meeting some of the concerns about the citizen's income. I mean, it does sound a pretty strange idea. On the other hand, as Milton Friedman pointed out many years ago, it's actually just doing the same as giving people the cash equivalent of their personal tax allowance. So it's actually not that radical. Okay, now, next. How am I doing? Yeah. One of the important points I stress in the book is that although I've just been talking about taxes and transfers, it's not just taxes and spending. Nearly half of the proposals I make in the book are concerned with the market distribution of income. Indeed, one of the key messages is that we can't reduce inequality by 10 percentage points, that's what we're trying to do, simply by taxes and transfers. So, the first thing is unemployment. Strangely missing from the discussion in my country, the government campaigned in May in the general election saying that unemployment rate of 5% was a great success. I gather in Sweden you have an unemployment target, is that right? To achieve the lowest level of unemployment in the European Union, which seems to be a rather interesting, sensible target. But I would like to stress this because we seem to have slipped into accepting levels of unemployment. And when I was a student in Cambridge, England, unemployment was around 1%. At that time, the Prime Minister of New Zealand said he knew all the unemployed in his country. And being a sceptical social scientist, I looked up the numbers, and there were 55 people unemployed in New Zealand. So it could well be. So unemployment targets is one thing I propose. Here you already are ahead of what I suggested. But of course then there's the question of how this is going to be achieved. And I think we have to recognise that for 30 years we have tried to reduce unemployment. We've tried to get back to the kind of levels there were in the post-war decades. But we've failed. And I think we've failed for several reasons. But one of the reasons is that we focused too exclusively on the supply side of the labour market, on the reactions by workers, rather than on the demand side, the behaviour of employers and aggregate demand. That's one reason why I propose that the government should act as an employer, a guaranteed employer. Again, not a particularly radical idea, and has been adopted a number of times in a number of countries. And indeed, we already have the EU Youth Guarantee, which is a guarantee for people under 25 of a job, training, apprenticeship, or further education. But I think we've yet to see quite how member states are actually going to implement that. But certainly, it seems important that we should take seriously the demand side of the labour market. And particularly, I think, the role of employers. And I was an employer, sort of, for quite a number of years. I ran a college. And I remember thinking at the time, I felt under no social pressure with regard to employment. No one ever said to me, oh, how many apprentices do you have? Or, you know, how much do you invest in your workers? And at the end of it, I thought, it's really strange. There was no sense of being, as there used to be, a sense of being a good employer. A good employer was someone who looked after their workers, invested in their workers, and so on. Now, of course, that's relevant to the fact that it's not just jobs, but pay. At the moment, half the people who find work in the European Union after being unemployed earn less than they need to reach the poverty line. So pay levels is clearly a major issue. I supported the move to a living wage in the United Kingdom. The living wage was a voluntary arrangement, which among other things illustrates the role played by individuals, because pressure, say, from students persuaded universities to pay a living wage. Pressure from customers often persuaded employers to pay a living wage, and so on. So there's clearly a lot we can discuss about employment. What about capital and wealth? In the discussion of Thomas Piketty's book, it was called Capital, but actually most of what he wrote about was wealth. And I think it's important to keep these separate. And we've seen in most countries, certainly here, certainly in the United Kingdom, a dramatic change in the distribution of wealth over the last century. 100 years ago, most people didn't own their house, about, I think, 10% were owner-occupiers. This is the UK. Most people didn't have lots of consumer durables. Most people didn't have cars, obviously. Most people didn't have small savings. And there was only middle classes tended to have much in the way of saving. And that's clearly changed. It's clearly changed partly because of pensions schemes providing effectively with wealth. But what hasn't necessarily changed is the control over the assets that are owned by the bottom 99%. There hasn't been a corresponding equalisation of the control over economic decisions. I mean, in the UK, perhaps more than here, a lot of people have defined contribution pensions. My pension fund, the second biggest holding is in HSBC Bank. Now, I have no say at all about rather important decisions, like whether HSBC Bank is going to move out of London to the Far East. Major implications. I think that's for customers and for workers. I have no control over how they'd run their tax office in Zurich either. You may remember it was a matter of some controversy. So clearly one of the things that I was concerned about then was this issue of rebalancing power. And I think that there are several directions which this could take. It includes, for example, reintroducing discussion of distributional consequences into competition policy, antitrust policy. It was originally, but it has been taken out in most countries. It includes, for example, just to take a current instance, ensuring that negotiations about TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, should actually involve the people who are going to be affected, the individuals, the workers, consumers. At the moment, not even national governments seem to have much say in it. So I think that the questions about control over capital are ones that we need to spend some time on, and that would affect the market distribution of income and could be used as an equalising source. And then I also talk, again partly in reaction to Thomas Piketty's book, about increasing the wealth of small savers. I mean, I had quite a lot of people said to me, Piketty talks about R greater than G, R being the rate of interest and G being the rate of growth. And they said to me, my R is very low. My bank statement shows I get 0.15% last year on my savings, which is a lot probably less than the growth rate. So R greater than G is, well, there is a question of where the rest of the R is going. And that's why I think issues, for example, to help small savers, for example, by providing index links savings for small savers and so on. I also talk about sovereign wealth funds, but I won't go into that because I'm keeping my eye on the watch. In fact, let me turn to a sort of summary. I've been through a number of the proposals, and there's clearly much that can be discussed. Are they to be taken seriously? The New Yorker had a nice piece about my book in March, and they said, oh, this is all very interesting, but it's for those people over there. You know, it's for Europeans, it's not for us lot. I mean, this won't run on Broadway. They seem to have forgotten. They have short memories. In 1978, the US Congress passed the Humphrey-Hawkins Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act, which, among other provisions, authorised the US president to form a reservoir of public jobs. He didn't actually do it because unemployment began to fall already. But he was authorised by, I think, both parties, bipartisan Congress decision. They forget that when Republican Senator Sherman initiated the Antitrust Act, he said he was doing so because nothing, to quote, was more threatening than the inequality of condition of wealth. So I don't think these ideas are necessarily off the wall. And as you can see, I've given a few more examples. The Premier League clubs have begun to sign up for the living wage. I don't think the players needed it, but they're certainly their ground staff and others need it. But of course, there are other examples. Of course, you can object to what I've proposed. And the last slide, which I'll leave up, gives some of the objections and some of the reasons why I'm not persuaded by the objections. But let me just end by going back to what I said at the beginning, which was, I said, if we want to reduce inequality, then there are things we can do. But there are, of course, respects in which we have already agreed to do it. As I said earlier on, the Europe 2020 agenda does have an explicit goal of reducing the number of people in poverty. The Sustainable Development Goals. One of them includes making sure that the incomes of the bottom 40% grow faster than the rest of the population, which they haven't in China in recent years, nor have they in Sweden. By looking again at the Swedish fiscal policy report, the bottom 40% all had a smaller rise in income from 2006 to 2013. So by that, I think, rather simple, rather straightforward criterion, there is clearly a lot to be done. And I think we should, as the English expression goes, hold our leaders' feet to the fire. As you say, if you've signed up to these agreements, what are you going to do about it? If you don't like what I propose, which I can perfectly understand, how then do they plan to meet the target? And I think by bringing pressure to bear on our elected leaders, and of course by our own actions in many respects too, there are things that we can do to bring about less inequality than there is today. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.